Okay, good morning, everyone. Hi, and welcome to the our third donor call of 2016. This is Jess Haney with Critical Resistance, and I'm here with our panelists for our Beyond Attica Toward a New York Without Prisons call and discussion. So these donor calls are something that we put on three times a year to invite our donors to hear about the work that we're a part of as we're advancing the movement to abolish the prison industrial complex. And they're available online as well as folks joining us for the live call. So our conversation today, Beyond Attica, Toward a New York Without Prisons, is connected to the work that our CR New York City chapter is part of in the Beyond Attica Coalition and Campaign. And this conversation most intentionally falls on the 45th anniversary of the Attica Rebellion. And we plan this to commemorate the uprising and also to highlight the sustained movement work that's been happening since the 1970s to abolish the inhumane conditions and torturous practices of the prison industrial complex. So for folks who would appreciate a quick summary of the Attica Rebellion, I'd encourage you to visit freedomarchives.org and or look on Vimeo. There's two great movies on Attica. One is Attica is All of Us, and the other is a film on Attica by Ashley Hunt. They both are groups that have worked with CR and in our movement around recognizing this rebellion as an important keystone in the struggle. So on September 9, 1971, 1,200 prisoners at Attica State Prison in upstate New York seized control of the prison, demanding better living, working, and educational conditions. And the rebellion lasted for 4 days, so 45 years ago today, until the New York State Police stormed the prison, killing 29 prisoners and 10 hostages. This uprising and seizing control of the prison with demands represented a new level of resistance inside and made very visible and inspired further organizing amongst Black Puerto Rican communities, white rank and file organizers, and beyond, against the oppression of imprisonment and the violent kinds of repression which the state used to smash the uprising. So it also ignited popular imagination and determination for freedom inside and outside of prison. And so we hope to be invoking this energy and connecting it to the current grassroots organizing that's happening today. So today we want to highlight what's happening in New York State with efforts toward decarceration and reducing the number of people locked up inside and closing prisons in New York. So today on our call we have Laura Whitehorn from Release Aging People in Prison, or RAP campaign. We have Five from Incarcerated Nation, and we have Jack Norton from Critical Resistance New York City, and who is also part of the Beyond Attica Coalition, as is Five. So today I want to ask each of our folks on the call who are presenting to speak a bit about how your organization or your project is advancing the movement for freedom for imprisoned people and building towards a New York that does not rely on and use imprisonment. So I would like to open it up by inviting Jack Norton from Critical Resistance and the Beyond Attica Coalition to share what CR New York City is doing and the Beyond Attica campaign.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jeff Norton, and I'm a member of CR New York City and one of the co-founders of the Beyond Attica campaign. Now, the Beyond Attica campaign, well, it's a coalition. It's a statewide coalition of organizers and community members who have joined together to close Attica State Correctional Facility. And Attica represents an epicenter of racist brutality and inhumane treatment, both in sort of the U.S. prison system and especially in the New York State prison system. And we're organizing to close it immediately. And because imprisonment is fundamentally violent, we're working to reduce the number of prisons and people in prison in New York and to what we call like reconstruct New York, to build a safer and stronger New York where resources that are now wasted on caging people are free to build things that help communities thrive, things like education, housing, healthcare, and community services. So the coalition started, I think it was almost 2 years ago, and it comes out of a call by the then director of the Correctional Association, Sophia Elijah, in 2011 on the 40th anniversary of the uprising to close Attica. And if I can take you back to 2011 for a minute, in New York State, in January of 2011, that was when Governor Andrew Cuomo, in his first State of the State speech, signaled that he was going to start closing prisons in New York State, and he used a moral argument, and it was sort of the first time that we had heard anything like that in the state for kind of a long time at such a high level. And what he said was, prisons can't be used as a job development. We can't put some people in prison to get other people jobs, right? And since 2011, Andrew Cuomo, the governor, has closed 13 prisons. Now, the population, the number of people in the New York State prison system peaked at a high of over 72,000 at the turn of the millennium in like 1999-2000, and it's since lowered down to 54,000. I think that's where it's at now. Now, remember, when the Attica Rebellion happened in 1971, the number of people in New York State prisons was at 12,000. And at that time, the violence of imprisonment was recognized. People were talking about abolishing prisons then, how 12,000 was too many and how prisons had to go. So there was this sixfold increase. There's a slight decrease. And Andrew Cuomo, in his governorship, has managed to close, 13 prisons. And these 13 prisons that Andrew Cuomo has closed are, like, small, generally small, like 200 people, generally, like, minimum security prisons or prisons with drug treatment programs, like the one in Shattuck. We definitely applaud the closure of prisons and shrinking of the system. Part of what we're trying to do in this coalition is point to, like, the need to close, the need to get to the center of this, really, and to really confront the system and to really decarcerate New York. In Attica, which is the second largest prison in New York State, it's out by Buffalo, you know, Attica is a symbolic place because of the rebellion. It's a place of struggle. It's a place that people know about, right, that people know about outside of the state. But Attica is also a very real place that exists still. I mean, it's still there. And it's a place of horror. It's a place where people are sent sort of for punishment, even within the New York State prison system. And it's a place that cannot be reformed, right? Attica is doing exactly what it was built to do, which is to shorten people's lives and to torture people and to inflict violence on people and to destroy communities in New York. So what we're saying in this, in our coalition, what we're working towards is to confront the system where it matters, not around the margin, and to say that we want Attica shut down. We have a few more minutes. We have a four-point platform, so I just want to go through those points now. The first point, like I said, is to close Attica now, to close this institution immediately and permanently. The second is to end violence and abuse across New York City prisons, which is to say transform conditions in the short term and empower incarcerated people in the short term to build a more affirming culture. So we're saying address conditions now for people that are there now. The third point is to decarcerate New York. So we know that the only way to reduce prisons or reduce violence in prisons is to shut those prisons down. So we're saying reduce the number of prisons and the people in prison, and target the prisons with abusive staff, and not just around the edges, but places like Attica, places like Clinton. And the fourth point is reconstruction. So to transform prison-dependent economies by reinvesting in humane alternatives that employ and empower people in New York, and to move funding and resources from corrections and law enforcement to education, housing, health, and human services that support and strengthen our communities, and to build on transformative justice strategies that reduce harm and address the root causes of violence and inequality. So like I said, we've been meeting for about 2 years now. We recently had a rally to close Attica and to deliver a letter to the governor, a letter with a petition to close Attica. It had hundreds of signatures. So we rallied on September 8th, and some former brothers of Attica spoke to people on the street in front of the governor's office in Midtown Manhattan on 40th Street. And yeah, I'll leave it at that, and I'll let people ask questions.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Jack, for that introduction to the campaign and the groundwork for where the campaign came from in recent years. Five, could we pass it off to you since you've been part of this coalition since the jump, and we'd love to hear what you bring to the Beyond Attica campaign and coalition and the work that your organization is doing.
Yes, thank you. So my name is Five Wally Mock. I'm just one of the many co-founders of Incarcerated Nation Corp, which is a collective of people directly impacted, all who operate projects that does service to those incarcerated, previously incarcerated, and their families. And as a collective, we're also speakers on our own subject. So we teach one of the nation's largest student groups that teaches in prisons. We're in 19 states right now. We're in four states functionally that teach into facilities. So we teach the students who teach in the prisons on conditions of confinement. We also create unique educational events and film consultations. So we do the curriculum and the write-up in some sense. We also help produce films. So this way we're changing the national narrative of how the perception is seen. Far too much in media in the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen that we wasn't getting the stories and the articles and the atrocious things were happening out. So Jazz and Lukman, one of the founders, two of the founders, who also had previously had created the Attica's All of Us events, which were huge, before the rebirth of Beyond Attica. So that's why my initial commitment was to that as well. So we do media consultation. We're creating also another network, and this way we can get outreach done to the communities but provide events, unique events for family members. And we created also working with the campaign to end the new Jim Crow. Each one of us has our own nonprofit project, and in the last year we've created 8 other nonprofit projects from those returning citizens. This means we go into the prisons, have guided people, help them reintegrate, and started their own nonprofit projects. So that's a little bit about what INC is doing, and our commitment, my personal commitment to this is, of course, shutting down Attica. It's a horrific institution. But more or less, people come from there damaged and abused, and it's a regular routine, but it is the symbolization of Attica, which lets it remain and why it needs to be tamed down. And that symbolization is that we will not, never again, in some sense, as the officers say, we will not allow all people directly affected by the issue and people incarcerated and prisoners to literally rise up against them. So it's an overuse of force, and you're not considered. Anybody who's done time in New York State knows that the officers have a perspective that you're not considered fully trained unless you've been through Attica, right? And we see the horrific horrors in Attica RMU because people are literally dying in there and allowed to die. So by tearing down that system, We also have to functionally and fundamentally have a plan, because Attica produces of income for docs. Also, the Corecraft Corporation, which literally makes one of the only businesses that makes 100% profit, Attica was one of the first shops, and the welding shop makes a significant amount of income to that system. So tearing it down is going to take a more cohesive movement. That was also my initial commitment to being a part of the Beyond Attica, because what's happening beyond it, right? If we tear down that facility with inadequate mental health services, inadequate just health services, period, and the brutality and the nature of the officers are to be extra brutal.
Bob, are you still with us?
Sorry about that. I do apologize. I was in transit and a little out of the announcement. So our commitment is always to the betterment of those. We also do reintegration services by creating permanent housing, and then we collaborate and work with all of the people who are doing transitional housing so that we're all one cohesive force to assist those reintegrating from society. And we see those who come from Attica every time, and of course all of us who have been there, know that it's an abuse story, an abuse auto. Or an abuse case, and an issue with this. I didn't have this prepared before I came home because there is no system of support there. And it's one of the oldest institutions, and it stands as a benchmark as into what the town does. We actually teach the prison industrial complex using Attica as an example and how the town came up out of this prison. And we live in a county, a state, with over 60 counties and over 60 prisons named after each county, and it's the only employment revenue of that state. But we have to look beyond Attica as into what's going to happen to the facility and the land use, and also the business that they're going to be missing. So we have to realistically create a system that can decimate that into either being resources for the surrounding members of the community, because there's so many poor farmers that surround that facility as well. And then not only tearing it down, but coming up with a cognitive plan to use the land mass, but also what's going to happen to the facility. Because, yes, we can say shut it down, but what's going to happen in the end? And Beyond Attica has been that network in which we all can come to the table in a think tank model and come up with these ideas. Sorry, I lost signal a little bit right there. So INC moving forward, INC moving forward, it's a never-ending list of us, and we're going to grow nationally. We're also a part of other national collectives and international collectives. We do national and international media consultation, which allows us to be a voice who are directly impacted, making change in the system, because we're making people aware, and there's going to be two sides of the story. The system and those directly impacted by the system. So we try to stand and defend our side and the family members so people can humanize and understand what other human beings are going through. Even though we all have our different titles, working collectively in this format, we consider ourselves human rights advocates because we are under the umbrella of the Anti-Torture Initiative, because these conditions and the three major conditions that we have, of course, our restoration of citizenship, all human rights aspects, the release of aging people in prison, and the fact that food should not be a system that depends on a capitalistic structure. And with those three main goals, we have increased steadily to move into other states and even other countries to work collectively.
Thanks so much, Five, for laying down the work of your organization and all the different approaches that you have, as well as bringing us back to before the Beyond Attica campaign with the Attica's All of Us events. and also carrying us forward towards the transformation horizon. So where you just left us with the your work falling under the umbrella of anti-torture work, with one of the points being releasing aging people in prison, seems like a perfect moment to pass it off to Laura Whitehorn, who's actually with the Release Aging People in Prison campaign in New York. Laura, could you tell us a bit about your work with RAP and what RAP has been up to and what you see the context that you're working in being?
Sure. Thank you so much for having us on here from RAP. First, I just have to say, since today is the 13th, it's kind of an emotional day in terms of Attica, because on the day that the massacre happened, when Governor Rockefeller ordered the state troopers to shoot and kill the incarcerated people who had led the uprising and who engaged in it, as well as the guards, I was on my way to Attica, a lot of us were, to support the rebellion, and a lot of work started from there. So I am from Release Aging People in Prison, RAP. Our website is rapcampaign.com. And we were, those of us who started it, a small number of people, very small, are all formerly incarcerated, and we were responding to a couple of things. And one is a call from people inside for people on the outside to help push the question of release, because if you ask most of the people in New York State, as some of our friends did, what do you want us to do, they said, get us out of here. But more seriously, in terms of abolition, our goal is to attack the paradigm, the system of permanent punishment in New York State, but in the country as a whole, which we believe, and I think probably everyone on this call agrees, stems directly from the racism in this country, white supremacy, from slavery, from the attempt by the state to contain and destroy black resistance, and more recently, the resistance of other people of color. So when we started RAP, which was around the end of 2012, beginning of 2013, we had noticed that the number of people over the age of 50, which is the age at which people who are incarcerated are categorized as being elderly because of the proof that people inside age at a pace about 10 years faster than people on the street. And that number of people inside was escalating by leaps and bounds, and there were media reports and political reports from all over the country showing that phenomenon. However, no one was saying that the solution is to let people go. And to say that points to the roots of mass incarceration, because the roots of mass incarceration are very often described as being a result of the war on drugs, which is definitely a human rights abuse against communities of color. However, we believe that the root of the huge rise in the number of people in prison in this country is more accurately tied to the existence, the institution of longer sentences, specifically for people convicted of crimes of violence, and also to the expansion of what's considered a crime of violence. If you look at the laws in this country as opposed to other countries, you see that a lot of things in this country are classified as violent, which are not in other systems. So we looked at that, and we said that there was a way of framing this issue that brought together the question of the permanency of punishment when the people involved are people of color, the question of how long should punishment be, what is punishment, and the question of how is the prison system going to be changed fundamentally, as well as reformed, whatever people are talking about. So we raise the question of long-termers, who are people who've served long sentences. In New York State, Jack was talking before about the numbers in New York State have gone down overall. I think in one 10-year period since 2000, the number of people overall fell by 23%. In that same period, the number of elders over the age of 50 in New York State rose by 84%. And I just checked it the other day with the new numbers that came out from the Department of Corrections. And this year, the number of people over the age of 50 has gone up over 10,000. So it is now 20% of the total population. So we need something that hits right at that if we're going to talk about decarcerating. And these are mostly people who were convicted of violent crimes. Some of them have been in for more than 40 years. This includes people who were convicted of political actions back in the 70s, people who were members of the Black Panther Party and other Black Power organizations. And in fact, if we're talking about Attica, Jaleel Muntakim, who's been in for, I think, now 44 years, who was a member of the Black Panthers, is in Attica right now suffering all those conditions. And we think that by pointing to this population, we are also exposing the fact that the prison system in this country has nothing to do with protecting public safety. Because if you look at this group of people, people, say, over the age of, let's just say, out of the blue, over 60, who have been in for, let's say, 15 or 20 years or more, and who are convicted of first-degree murder, have the lowest rate of recidivism of any group of incarcerated people. So we came up with the slogan, if the risk is low, let them go, because we're saying if the prison system is keeping people in for some reason other than protecting public safety, then that is part of the root of the problem that we face in this country. In RAP, we advocate and we organize. In other words, we go, we meet with politicians, we meet with the state attorney general. We push for the parole board to follow its own regulations, which I won't go into now, but if people are interested, they can look on the RAP website. We have a lot of stuff about the history of parole in this state and how it has been changed from a system that's supposed to let people out to a system that's supposed to keep people in. And we also organize because we feel that by raising these issues, which are some of the harder issues about the prison system, we are challenging and creating in our communities a process by which we will eventually come up as a society with a different way of protecting and healing our communities from damage than the use of prisons and police. So we see this when we talk to community boards and to churches. We're talking about people taking a new role, not saying we're going to use the police and the prisons to take care of any questions of damage and violence in our societies, instead to say this is a community issue and we want a different system that doesn't end up punishing forever and further decimating and hurting our communities. And that's, I think that's about it for this particular issue. We are definitely in support of closing Attica. We also really also always want to raise the issue that closing prisons is only one part of decarceration. The real heart of decarceration is letting people out.
Thanks, Laura, so much for breaking that down clearly, and also bringing us back to the emotional significance of today, and sharing with us your story about being on the road there.
Can I just say one other thing? I'm so sorry, but can I say one other thing about Attica and why it's so important? A couple of years ago, some of us, some formerly incarcerated, some young activists, did an exhibit that went on for a few months called Self-Determination Inside Out, which was about the fact that people inside, incarcerated people, have not been the object of social justice movements. They have been the leaders of social justice movements, raising issues like the 13th Amendment, keeping slavery in place for anyone who's been convicted of a crime, and the need for an internationalist view of oppression so that we don't isolate the things that happen in this country from things around the world, all those sorts of things. And it started with the Attica Rebellion. And going back to the demands of the rebellion and the people who were involved was extremely moving, because it reminded us that it was the brothers at Attica who taught this country that prisons are not about public safety, they're about oppression and violence. And so I think that that is really held up in the campaign to close Attica, and also beyond Attica, what comes from that, that this is something that began with the incarcerated people in that prison and is continuing that way.
Laura, that's so sharp. And that reminds me to mention that the Beyond Attica campaign platform was very much informed by interviews that Critical Resistance did as part of the Attica Interview Project with people like Five who have been through Attica. And we talked with folks about prisoner organizing and exactly what Five was saying about what's needed with transformation and coming home, and brought those to the table to inform the Beyond Attica campaign platform. So even that is, as you said, directly informed and led by people who have been through the prison system, been through Attica, and are leading the call for what our points of unity and vision are. I want to encourage folks who are on the call here to come up with any questions you might have for our wonderful speakers. And I'm wondering also, Laura, Five, Jack, do you have any questions to ask of each other? I don't want to put anyone on the spot. I just want to open that up as a possibility.
I have a question generally. I wonder if anyone, since I just got back from California from the conference, the national conference of the organization that Five and I are both members of, as well as Mujahid Farid, who's the other main organizer of RAP, the Formerly Incarcerated Convicted People and Families Movement. And so I've been a little out of touch with the news. What's happening with the current prison strike that was announced, the national strike, which was announced to go on specifically on the anniversary of Attica, if anyone knows?
Anyone have an update?
Yes. So there, it's actually the largest, you know, prison strike as well. And one of the things that I would just want to say really quick about New York and why Attica is so pinnacle to be torn down is because they do something which is called a PK draft, and they would literally pack up five different prisons and switch the those incarcerated around. And that was a direct result of the Attica uprising. And they created this method to just sort of mantle a system of organizing where they will shift people from jail to jail overnight. And we fear that's going to happen because every facility, there is things happening. But people don't understand, and I want to make this a certain point. I know Laura understands this as well. I want to make sure that the general audience understands this. On Attica Day, it's a system of unity. If you are participating in a silent protest by not eating in the mess hall, which actually is a huger system of how the farms were at the time abusing people incarcerated because they were using them on the farms. We now work with those farmers as well to disenfranchise the system. But the work is done by those inside because everyone's sharing their own food. Everyone is saying, no, we're not going to eat this food tonight. We're going to make a silent protest, and we're actually going to eat together. And it creates relationship and movement building and solidarity and humanity. And that's what human beings are supposed to do. But this prison opposes that. This is the prison that insisted reckless eyeballing stay within the rule book when they reconcerted it in 2006 and took other issues out. Of course, they added five more. But reckless eyeballing was looking a guard in his eyes, which came from the convict leasing laws in the state as well. So I just wanted to point that out, that there are a lot of demonstrations going on now And it may get hectic, but this is the largest collaboration in the state.
Yeah, I believe it's across 20 or 26 or 24 states,
yeah.
And organized people from over 40 prisons. It was done through a lot of letter writing organizing as well as digital communication. And I'm looking up the news right now, and I don't see updates for what is happening now on day four. But if anyone else has an update, I would encourage them to share it. But if we don't, maybe that's something that we could round up and share out after this call. And I'm wondering if both Laura and Five, you've referred to this inside-outside organizing. And Jack, I know that CR does some of this through letter writing, but could you all share maybe some examples of folks of how inside-outside organizing happens? Because it's incredibly difficult. We know, like I know it's some of the slowest organizing that can be done. It's incredibly important to be building across prison walls through the vast geographic space that's forced between us, as well as all of the control and repression that is physically created between people communicating. So how does this inside-outside organizing happen? How have you all been successful in building across this imposed distance and control? And any of you can answer, Jack, Laura, or Five.
Well, I can start because this is Laura, because I did a lot while I was incarcerated for a little more than 14 years. And we didn't start out planning to do this, but we noticed that it happened is that people on the outside who understand what it is to be in prison, who know that you're, I mean, literally in the belly of the beast, and things like it's amazing looking a guard in the eye is seen as a challenge. I mean, what does that remind you of? Slavery and Jim Crow. And there are no particular rights of people inside, including the right of assembly. We weren't allowed to gather to plan anything. So I think the most recent example was the hunger strikes in California and Ohio and other prisons, where people on the outside see that when people inside are willing to jeopardize the little shred, which is not much, of comfort or control that they have over their lives in order to point to the abuses that are going on, then people on the outside become more aware of it. So what we did from the inside a lot of times was we used artwork. We used letters, yes. And we also, I mean, at one point nationally, all the political prisoners who were in prison in the early 80s, mid-80s and early 90s, did art specifically about the death penalty and the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and that helped to advance that particular struggle. I think it's very important for people who are not incarcerated to understand what the stakes are for people inside and how much, for example, when in the federal system, there were points when we tried to call out to on the phone to an event or a gathering, a meeting, and then have someone put us on speakerphone. And very often you would get written up for that and thrown in the hole. The prison administrators are very aware of the importance of breaking. You know, the walls are there for a reason. So I think that that's one starting point. And that if that's not understood by people on the outside, then it can really endanger people inside. But I think that I think one of the things that Critical Resistance does, that the California Coalition for Women Prisoners does, and many other groups, is to print the letters that they get from people inside, with the people inside's permission, obviously, so that other people can read what's going on. Those are just a couple of immediate thoughts.
survivor, Jack, do you have anything to add about organizing inside outside?
Yes. I was just waiting for Laura to speak because I always follow in the footsteps and the orders of our elders who have been there before us, but also this is our guidance. So organizing outside, inside and outside is because we are the people inside and outside. The family members are part of the suffering system when it's affected. When a person is incarcerated, their entire family is incarcerated. The children, the community, the neighborhood, everything is directly impacted. So we organize through those steps because those are the people who are literally involved in the entire process of slavery. But there is a huge threat, and one of the common grounds is all of the labeling of segregated isolation. So not only are you isolated from society and your family members in prison in the system of slavery itself, but you are then further isolated into a dungeon version of that, buried into the basement in ice and solitary. And we have created, through the orders from Jalil, because I've done time with the elder in Auburn as well, and my direct orders was to create a letter-writing system, which, of course, James Ridgway and Gene Casella from Solitary Watch has helped to support. And from day one, it wasn't even a question of doing it, called Lifelines to Solitary, and we created, I launched a student group out of Princeton called Sphere, and my students letter write to the majority of people in Solitary. And during the California hunger strike, I mean, we had demands, and we started with a unified peace treaty in some sense, and that allowed us to seamlessly start the protests and the hunger strike from the honor block, not even from Solitary, and over 80,000 people were hunger striking, and not even for saying let me out and relieve me of my charges, but I just want human rights. And one of our comrades actually hunger strike until he passed away. I mean, these people were there with threatening force feeding, and the element of any type of organizing is with swift response. I remember being on the in communication with Jalil, who's in Attica, and here it is, a fight breaks out, and they start shooting in his direction in the yard, right? Because you are the target if you are considered an organizer. And even if you have nothing to do with it, once you are labeled an organizer, you in your cell, you know, like a cage, which is the slave unit, and you're going to work the next day because forced servitude is mandatory, and you get up and your door's locked because you're under investigation because something happened on the other side of the jail. And they have security threat units, security risk units, security control management units, special housing units, solitary, and if, you know, they feel like you're a threat in any way, they'll write up a paper and the administration will lock you away and furtherly restrict you from any human contact at all. So we're talking about within the system of slavery and how slavery was in America, there was always a punishment paradigm, right? And when we think about solitary, we always try to put a label on it, and sometimes people who are not involved or haven't been directly impacted put a label on it and try to put blames on it, you know? But they say, oh, the Quakers started solitary because they tried to institutionalize it. Well, slavery was a punishment. I mean, solitary was a punishment system from slavery, and which is, you know, why I love the movie Django so much, because people always ask me, well, when did we start putting women in the box? We started putting humans in the box because the psychological punishment can furtherly deter a person from resisting. So if you're working in forced servitude and you're picking cotton in 120-degree weather, and how worse can it be? You could be whipped as a slave, beat as a slave. If you run away, they'll cut your foot away. If you try to crawl away, they'll cut your leg off. But they'll just put a metal box in the middle of the cotton field and bury you in it and have people work around you knowing that you're suffering, saying, oh, if you don't want to do this, if you dare organize or dare educate yourself, oh, it could get worse. We'll put you in that box. So that is where a lot of the communication has come from, and the letter writing has come from communication with students, but also supporting the family members. Look at you, and these are political prisoners who have been in prison for my entire lifetime already, and Herman Bell's project, who is also organizing the Freedom Food Alliance, where we provide transportation and food and nourishment for the family members. And that is how we have been communicating and supporting those who support those inside, because we are one big family. But the punishment is actually risking your life.
Yeah, can I just say, that's really well said, Five. This is Laura again. Just one last thing is that in New York State, all you need in order to visit someone is valid identification. You know, in the federal system, you have to go through this unbelievable process, and you have to prove that you knew the person before they were incarcerated, which the longer people are held inside, the harder it becomes, right, because you have younger people who want to visit, and they never can. But in New York State, the first thing I did when I got off parole was to go in and visit Herman Bell. And visiting is really important in addition to letter writing, because when I have this all the time with Jaleel and with Herman and with David Gilbert, another political prisoner in New York State, is that we need to talk with people when they have ideas about what we should be doing and they have their issues and they want to know how we can support them. We have to discuss what's going on outside, what conditions are, all that kind of stuff, stuff that they don't know because they've been locked up for almost 50 years. And it takes that kind of discussion, political discussion, that can only happen in person. So I really always encourage people to begin visiting people. Some of the prisons are within, you know, Sing Sing is within like a half an hour drive or something, or bus ride from New York City. And I'm always a little sorry to see how few people who are involved in the movement against prison injustice actually spend time going up to visit people in the prisons. So I think that's another part of this issue of communication.
Those are excellent concrete examples. And I hope people take note of ways to be building, learning from what works and what has been powerful and impactful before. I have two questions on the tip of my tongue, but again, I'm going to pause. Are there any questions that people have that they'd like to ask? Else I'll just keep rolling. We have about 5 minutes left, so this is a chance. Okay. So Five had put something about points of unity, so I'm very close to asking a question about platforms, but I'm wondering first about this moment. Laura, you said talking with folks inside about what the context is and what's happening politically in this moment. What are opportunities that people see in this current climate, whether that's socially or politically in New York State or nationally, to be pushing hard for what we've talked about, which is shifts and advances not just around the edges, as Jack was saying, but towards more hard-hitting levers that are going to get people out, that are going to close institutions. What's happening now? What are opportunities you see? And Jack, we haven't heard from you in a minute. If you're still with us, I want to invite you to go first if you have anything to add on this.
Okay, thank you, and thanks, everyone. Yeah, I do think it's an opportune moment. I think there are a lot of opportunities in all the work that Five and Laura are talking about. I'm talking about getting people out, continuing real decarceration in New York will open up even more opportunities. I do think that Governor Patterson and Governor Cuomo closing are being forced by social movements in the state to end up closing some facilities. Social movements and sort of like a fiscal goal in the state to close some facilities is an opportunity. I wanted to say something just quickly about like another legacy of the Attica Rebellion. Which is, you know, on one hand, there was an intensely, like, brutal and racist response to the Attica Rebellion, which was inherent in the system and it continues to the present day. And we associate that with a sort of conservative law and order response. On the other hand, the state of New York responded to the Attica Rebellion with prison expansion, in a way. Like, they wanted to, I mean, if you look at the history of prison expansion in New York State and what Mario Cuomo did, building 39 prisons between, well, actually 39 prisons were built between 82 and 2000. Mario Cuomo presided over most of them. Like, that was part of a process of depoliticizing incarcerated people's organizing and turning it into a question of sort of better conditions and building more prisons to contain all of that. So if you look at like the years between 1971 and 1983, when there was a rebellion in Sing Sing, after the rebellion in Sing Sing, there was less talk about like the sort of radical politics of that and more just a rush to quote-unquote better conditions in the prison system by expanding the system massively and building new prisons. But and the reason I want to say all that is because it's just knowing that makes it like all that much more important to look at this moment and look at the opportunities in front of us and just be very careful about what kind of reforms we push and just to be cognizant of like the need to, like Laura said, really push for decarceration and lasting decarceration in New York City and not to just work around the edges and not to let Mario Cuomo's son, Andrew Cuomo, sort of distract us with a closure here or there. You know, we want a real end. Like, let me put it this way. It's like New York State, since Attica, 71, has had a plan all this time. They have been planning to lock people up. They've been planning to criminalize people, and they've been planning to destroy communities of color, and they planned it out. They wrote the plans, they floated the bombs, and they did it, and we need to seize the opportunity to make a new plan. So not just to close a few facilities, but to truly decarcerate and to rebuild and reconstruct New York State.
That is so, I really think that's important and true. And I would just add one point, which is that one of the key points that sort of thing pivots on, where we're going to either see changes that will make this system prettier and more impervious to attack because it won't look as brutal, or changes that really fundamentally threaten the way the system works, is if we allow the language that gets floated of let's release the low-level nonviolent quote-unquote offenders, a word that I particularly hate of all the words that dehumanize people in prison, then we will end up with the same system. You know, now some people point to this as a matter of numbers, that in New York State, for example, something like 64% of all the incarcerated people have crimes of violence. So if you only let, if you want to reduce the number of people in prison, you can't do it if you don't let people out who are convicted of violence. But I think that more fundamentally, because of what Five and I were saying about the punishment paradigm and the sense that some people don't get a second chance, some people don't get a chance to be rehabilitated, whatever, however you want to frame it, I think that right now that's a really key point to be talking about, because if people in systems of power are trying to figure out how can I look like a reformer, we can't allow them the room to do something like, say, solitary should not be used for, quote, particularly vulnerable populations. No, it shouldn't be used for anyone in prison. And the people who should be allowed out on parole or who should be allowed education or whatever else we're talking about, whether we're talking about conditions or decarceration, should not be limited to people who are, quote, low-level nonviolent cases. And we've been trying to talk with all of our comrades and allies in the prison justice movement about that because we think that some of these things we must speak with one voice. And that's just the last thing I'll say is one of the reasons I like talking about the Beyond Attica campaign and all these campaigns is that we are working together, and we need to work together even more.
And I know you're gone. Excuse me. This is my sorry for being late. And I agree with all of that. I just wanted to add to a point. If y'all didn't, it was like Attica. They also think not just the building of more prisons, but one of the things some folks mentioned a whole lot is that after Attica, there was an increase in the building of control units. By a lot of different names, I'm sure y'all know them, and it's like it was because what Attica stirred in people was that the idea of acting and not just as prisoners, but it was so attached to human rights that states and the federal government saw the need to increase the control units. And a lot of times folks doing a lot of the work they're talking about, they sleep on that. And I know I got to go, but I want to say, like, because I'm just coming back from France. We came yesterday, and folks was interested. Like, pointed out that, you know, it's tied to the Attica rebellion, folks said in their solidarity, and maybe we have some statements on that later. But that was one of the things that sometimes people sleep on, that Attica spurred so many things around human rights, and I think it was one of the first times it was so clearly articulated about what they were. Not just, that we're not just these. I mean, like, they meant it in so many different ways. And like I said, I'm sure y'all might have covered all of that. My time sense was off. I wanted to be on the call, and I had a different time in mind. I'm just finding it. So we did raise, we raised Attica. We raised the hunger strike while we were there. So we tried to. But I think getting control units is so important that prisoners not get a chance to organize as human beings and connected to the struggle outside.
Masai, I'm so glad you joined us. This is Jess, and it's great to hear your voice. I think that, I'm hearing Laura, Jack, Masai, what you're all wrapping us up with are some really clear lines, right, about what to be keeping our eyes wide open on in this moment where there are some really, really big threats and obstacles. To what gains we could be making, and that runs from drawing hard lines against who is permanently punishable, and then who, you know, with that language, Laura, like we at CR also despise around like low level, et cetera, et cetera. And then Masai, like that line around from control units and then to what Laura had pointed to way earlier in our conversation in policing, right? So at this moment, making sure that in the conversations of decarceration, there's not a bulge on either end towards expansion of control units or geographic control and community control with expansions of policing. So it's really good to be talking across our movement that the conversation about prisons and closing prisons isn't just about those buildings, but it's about all these aspects of the prison industrial complex. And we're just past one now, Eastern time, so I'm going to wrap us up and thank everybody so much for joining. Please check out Release Aging People in Prison RAP's campaign online, Incarcerated Nation, Beyond Attica Coalition. And, of course, thank you for being supporters of Critical Resistance and to our amazing panelists and contributors on the call today. I'm really excited that this is more than just, not just a radio show, but we're going to continue to working together in coalition and campaign. So let's take that energy out there. Right on. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks all.
Thanks. Bye. Thanks.
Bye.